You're listening to Podium Podcast with former England rugby player Tom May and leading performance coach Simon Hartley. From locker room gossip to fascinating high-performance insights, this is the show that invites some of the biggest names in the world of sport to discuss life on and off the field of play. Podium Podcast is brought to you by True Potential. To find out more, visit www.tpllp.com.
Hey, Simon. Good to be back.
Mate. Back again.
Yeah. And this time it's hockey. Kate Richardson-Walsh.
Yeah. Yeah, she's fantastic. I mean, we invited her to speak at our conference a few weeks ago, and she had a phenomenal impact on our audience. You know, some of her insights, some of her experience, and her honesty were really, really powerful. Went down so, so well with our audience.
She got a ridiculous number of medals, four Commonwealth Games medals, two Olympic medals, one of which was gold in Rio. She's clearly someone that has been an integral part of hockey for numerous years. I'm expecting that she's going to be really insightful.
Yeah, yeah. And like you said, you know, playing career speaks for itself, but just her experience as an Olympian and what she's learned as an Olympian and how she now uses it, I think will be fascinating to unpick. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to this.
Well, let's chat to her. Kate Richardson-Walsh. Kate, lovely to have you with us on the Podium Podcast. How's life with you?
Yeah, no, thanks for having me on. I'm really looking forward to chatting. Yeah, life's good. Life is good. Busy, but good.
And what does busy look like now? Not charging around after a little ball anymore. Well, maybe there is a bit of that in terms of demonstrating, but yeah, what does life look like?
Yeah, coaching still gives me that kind of hockey fix. So I'm coaching Hampstead and Westminster. We're in the Premier League. so that's takes up a lot of my time, kind of, you know, video analysis, but also obviously looking after all the players, managing a big squad and staff. And then lots of keynote speaking, talking to various companies across a whole wide range of sectors. Still going to schools, still do some charity stuff for Access Sport. So yeah, a bit of this, that and the other.
How do you enjoy the speaking side of things?
I actually really like it. There was a time when I thought, you know, how much longer can I do this? Am I going to start getting bored of my own voice? But it's the people that I really, it's the people that I meet and the really different people that I meet. Because people are fascinating in the end, aren't they? And, you know, all these different teams of people and from different cultures, different countries, you know, different in every way. But in the end, it's all the same. It's people, it's culture, it's helping people thrive.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get, I'm going to say, comfortable with it? I mean, there are degrees of comfort when you're delivering keynotes, I know. But when you delivered to our conference, what is it now, 6 weeks ago, I know lots of people in our audience said, oh, my God, you know, she's so natural up there. And one of my personal reflections on keynote speaking is it took me quite a long time to feel vaguely natural and maybe come across that way. So what was that like moving into that world? Because it's not the same as playing sport. It's a very different set of skills and demands.
Yeah, really different set of skills and demands. But I suppose the buzz or the you know, the adrenaline rush you get just before you go out to play and just before you go out to speak are a little bit similar. You know, I have to really focus back in on my breath, just as I did when I was waiting in the tunnel to go out and play. You know, I have to really just think about the things that I want to hit and, you know, my job and the things I want to deliver and my body language and tone of voice. All of that is, you know, all of those things I did kind of focus on when I played in the end. And I love that. I think it's a bit of an addiction, probably, that addiction to that adrenaline rush. And I still get really nervous. And I think if I don't get nervous, I think I'll, you know, it's probably time to stop. I think there's something about, you know, you're going out to share your story and make yourself quite vulnerable. And I think, you know, that is quite scary.
Hmm. What did you get any coaching with regards to standing up and talking in front of people? Because there's a lot of people that get sort of shoved in front of a camera or stuck on a stage and sort of said, well, crack on, you know how to do this. And there's a huge amount of sports people that haven't had any coaching.
No. Really lucky, actually. I think through the British Climbers Association, but also through, I think, GB Hockey, over the years, we had media training companies come in. And just to help you, well, put you in some really challenging situations and, you know, some awkward things. You were kind of used to having a one-on-one conversation with maybe a print journalist or something, but, you know, down the line, when you're just staring down the barrel of a camera and you can't actually see a person, it's really weird. And or being thrown in front of a press conference that's, you know, something big's happened and you have to ask some hard questions. So we were really helped with some of that, some of the skills around that. So I think that helped. And then I suppose also just being captain, you kind of sometimes thrust into those positions when you're maybe not prepared, and you have to go and say a few words about somebody or a team. And I think over the years, again, you just build up a bit of a resiliency to that, and I guess learning of what works and what doesn't work.
I've had to talk a few law firms, and I was thinking last time, I was like, I've actually got no idea about whether what I'm doing is right or wrong. I'm just doing it. And I think I'm sort of basing that on the fact that actually I was a captain a few times, and you get used to being put in front of people and being told to stand up. And that really, that's the most uncomfortable bit for, I mean, you know your story, you know the trials and tribulations of, so you have confidence in that area naturally. But actually, it's the bit of standing up there and being in front of someone, which actually makes people terrified, isn't it? If you've had that covered off as a captain, it's probably a bit easier.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a bit easier. But I also, you know, regularly have to pinch myself and say, you know, your teenage self would be so proud of you right now, because I was super shy and would blush, you know, involuntarily in front of small groups. I could be talking to just one other person, and for no reason, I would just start to blush. And then I'd start to feel shame because I could see them see me blush. And then, you know, I would just withdraw and take myself away. And it was just the most awkward place to be. And I was doing that right up until my early 20s. And when I was still, you know, when I was made captain when I was 23, I was still doing that. And it was, in the end, just having to embrace it. It still happens to me now sometimes. I can feel my cheeks starting to flush and I'm like, oh God, I don't even know why I'm blushing. But then I'm thinking something's weird about this conversation because I'm now blushing. But I don't know. I don't know what it is, what triggers it. But but yeah, it's just something I had to, I suppose, just learn to get on with.
Simon, how many sports people do you think there's so many I know that have come from that background of feeling sort of very conscious about themselves, but actually sport is what brings it out of them?
Yeah, and as Kate was saying, actually, sometimes it's that just to meet the challenge that's right in front of you, you have to get out of your comfort zone. You have to do the things that you probably wouldn't maybe voluntarily take on. You wouldn't put yourself voluntarily in that situation because you know it's well outside of your comfort zone. But if you're, you know, if the sporting environment, if the demands that are around you almost force you into that, you end up coming out the other side saying, oh, well, actually, I didn't die there. I can do that stuff. You know, it's not fatal. Maybe I didn't do it as well as I could. Maybe I can learn something. I can probably do it better next time. But actually, maybe I can do this stuff. We hope you don't mind us interrupting the show with a very short message about our partners at the Podium Podcast, True Potential. True Potential provide wealth management that's simple, effective, and unique. Their expert advice, innovative investments, leading technology, and dedicated support are all designed to help you do more with your money. Visit www.tpllp.com now to find out more. Capital at risk. True Potential Wealth Management and True Potential Investments are authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. Thanks for listening. Now, let's get you back to this week's show.
Kay, you retired 6-7 years ago. Mm. How did you find that transitional period?
I think I'm still in it. I don't know if you ever get out of it. I found it really hard at times. obviously I was really grateful and I'm so lucky to have been able to finish at the top and to have chosen when I left. Like lots of my teammates have just not had that opportunity. So I did feel really grateful for that. And Helen and I were planning to retire about the same time. Helen wasn't 100% sure as I was. So we tried to kind of talk to lots of different people, different athletes that we'd kind of met along the way who had retired, get a bit of support, information, what did they do, what worked. And so we kind of planned out that first year, especially. So we went to go and play in the Netherlands for a season. And it was almost like, I think Karen Pickering talked about to me about tapering down, about not just kind of stopping, going cold turkey, never picking up a hockey stick again, but to go out to the Netherlands, which is still really high quality, domestic league, kind of semi-professional, you know, training a lot, but actually also being more social and being more relaxed and starting to get a bit of a sight line on what was going to happen next. We also planned a really big holiday because we'd barely had any holidays for the last goodness knows how many years. And then just started to kind of, you know, find our way and feel our way. And I think going through it with Helen, for the most part, was really helpful because we could really support each other through the kind of ups and the downs. And there was quite a lot of downs, you know, to the point where, you know, I'd just get up in the morning and be like, Hells, I'm feeling really low today. I don't know why. I don't know what's going on. I'm just really struggling. And she would just be like, I've got you. Like, what do you need for me today? What can I do to help, you know, get you through the day? And that was really, really helpful. And I think having that support system around you is super helpful. But yeah, as I say, I think I'm still kind of going through it.
Yeah, I think that there's often a difference, and I'd be keen to get Tom's thoughts on this as well, between people who really genuinely love the sport that they play and know that they've got to retire at some point. Yes, I mean, you got to choose it, some don't. You know, it might be injury or whatever. But there are some people who probably get to the end of their professional career and just don't want to do it anymore. Don't want to see another training field. Don't want to see another ball or whatever it is. But if you do love it, it is different because it's been such a huge part of your life that going cold turkey would be a really alien experience.
Yeah, I think so. I agree with that. I think, well, as you know, Simon, and as Becky has told me 1,000 times, I don't have to be training anymore, but it's something I do daily, basically. And that's only, you know, and I'm what, probably 8 years retired. And it's something that it's part of my day. Now that's only become because I've done it. I played and trained for so long that actually, if you took that out of my day now, the day feels weird. Mm. Now there's an element whereby I've sort of dipped my toe back into rugby, and that's through coaching, you know, younger teams now. But I think you're right. If you basically shut the door, you're either extremely confident of your ability to move forward, or quite frankly, you've probably been through the mill so much with injury that you never want to see the sight of a rugby ball again, or whatever sport you've been playing.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about my teammates that have retired and thinking about what you just said, I think, unfortunately, the vast majority of them, for many reasons, are just like, no, I'm done. I don't want to have any connection to that anymore. I've given it everything and it's chewed me up and smacked me out on the side. And I think that says something to how we care for athletes when they're in the program, but also when they leave the program. I think that requires more work.
I'm going to pick on that because that's something I know Simon knows. I'm sort of really, really interested in this space. So you feel that there's so much focus on athletes getting to the top of their game in career that actually when it comes to post-career and that support's there, I know we've got all those player bodies and the like that do a great job, by the way, but actually the job is that big to cover all of those athletes that have finished playing their sports that actually it's nigh on impossible for them to do a good job. Is that what you feel about that transitional period?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I suppose as Olympic and Paralympic sports, you helped through the EIS mostly. So we had performance lifestyle advisors. And, you know, you get a little bit of physio support, I can't remember, for a few months. And you get your medical insurance for a few months. And then it's kind of, and it's all cut off. I think Olympians and Paralympians, I think, are relatively well supported in terms of trying to plot out what happens next in terms of career. Mm-hmm. But I think it's more than that. It's psychology. It's a psychotherapy, maybe. It's that next level of support that I think athletes require. When they are, it feels like when you're going through that transition, you are losing part of yourself and probably quite a big part of yourself. And you start to really question your value and your worth and your role. And it's not all athletes, you know, it's a bit of a broad brush, but I think lots do at various points after their retirement. I think that requires very specialist support.
Yeah. Tom and I have reflected a few times that there are all sorts of elements to it. There's the identity piece, you know, who am I if I'm not a hockey player, rugby player, etc. But one of the others is finding something really meaningful, not just that's going to occupy you. And I think this is where, like you say, performance lifestyle and some of the professional bodies can help you find a job, but finding something that you're really passionate about that means something to you, because usually the sport does, you know, especially if you've been playing it since you were tiny, usually it's been a huge part of your life. And to step away from something that means that much to you creates a void. And that's one of the elements I think that's particularly challenging for athletes who've been immersed into a sport.
What areas, Kate, do you think you really suffered most? I mean, you mentioned sort of not, you know, you're not Kate the hockey player anymore, but, you know, there's losing your identity. But what other areas did you really struggle with?
I think a sense of belonging to something bigger than myself, particularly belonging to a team. I loved being part of a team. I loved, you know, picking my teammates up, them picking me up, just that vulnerability and connection to other people, which I think is very special. And I've not lost that. I still have that. We're still in the WhatsApp group. We still meet up all the time. So I still have that, but I think it's that alignment to something and you're striving towards a point together. I think that's one of the biggest things that I missed. And those moments that nobody sees, you know, in the change room when no one else is there, or after a hard training session, you're kind of like, you know, on the floor and that, you're just completely conked out. Like, I just think, you know, it's those things. And it's a grieving process. I think that's been the best way for me to get my head around it, is it's just, it is a loss. You know, I've lost that, and I will find, and I have found meaning in other things, but I have to grieve the loss of what I had. And that's completely natural and normal. And it might take me 6 years. It might take somebody else 6 months. And that's also completely fine.
Simon, this is not an issue that's going to go away, is it?
No. And actually, I think bizarrely, lots of sports are kind of in the early stages of exploring this, if you know what I mean, because we've had professionalism around the Olympic programs for quite a few years, a few Olympic cycles, but those people who have come out and retired and are now, you know, sort of 5, 6, 7 years into retirement, there aren't that many of them, really. You know, we're sort of at the early stages of this. I mean, rugby, for example, wasn't professional, became professional, and now we've got players who were professional have come out the other side of it. So actually, I think the understanding around this is still quite young and quite new. You know, we're having these sorts of conversations now, but I suspect we wouldn't have had, or the world wasn't having these conversations 10, 15 years ago. So yeah, I think there's we collectively are all learning our way through this still.
Do you think, Kate, that there's a... What are the really main features of a pathway for athletes to show? What are the things that really need to be focused on?
I do genuinely think it is psychotherapy, because I think obviously, and just in terms of, you know, the basics of financially being living, surviving, being, you know, human being, there is a need to be able to support athletes in finding a job and finding a career. And as you know, if you can find something that does give you meaning and creates an attachment to a purpose that you can align yourself to, I mean, amazing. Like, if you can find that, amazing. But I think it's fundamentally a greater support around that grieving process. And that might be counseling, it might be group stuff, you know, and we can lean on each other in those moments. I don't think it has to be, you know, every athlete needs this individual support. It can be, you know, having group conversations, forums, chats, sharing with each other. I think that would be really powerful. Because I think, well, for me, and to see, as I said, all my lots of teammates having gone through it, it's that more than anything else that I think needs specialist care and support. And if you look at kind of the military, you know, the military, I suppose that's something that's been talked about a little bit more often, transitioning out of the military. Now, that is, you are all in, it is a life, you know, mission, you know, it's very deeply ingrained. And when you come out of that, it must be completely surreal and challenging. And there's been a lot talked about around the support that you know, that those vets require. And I think it's maybe not to the same extent, but I think it's a similar support that's needed for athletes, for sure.
I 100% agree with that. And one of the things that I've actually started to say is actually, so there are grants that companies can access for employing former military personnel.
Oh, right.
And I think to a certain extent, that should be the same for sports people, because mm-hmm. yes, I agree with you. You know, there's no battlefield that we're going on to. It's a very different place. Yeah. But actually, the same problems of being in, you know, having something completely and utterly ingrained into you, being told what to eat, where to be, what to wear, mm-hmm. Don't do this, do that, for a long period of time. When you're sort of the changing room door is shut and you're kicked in the backside out the door, and you know there's someone else that's far better, and, you know, going to be far faster than you, on the block. Actually, you're left thinking, well, you know, now what?
Mm-hmm.
And having that ability and making that, I think, a realization for people in the wider world. And I mean that with the greatest respect. Like, I think most people think that sports people finish and they've got a bank account that's full of money. And that's not the case.
Or they're just going to walk into like a speaking career or something else because they've got medals.
Yeah.
Yes. And I mean, as you know, simply having the medals doesn't make you a good speaker.
No, absolutely not. And having medals doesn't make you happy. And you said having medals doesn't make you rich. It means you have got a lot of banked qualities and experiences that will absolutely help you for the rest of your life. But it doesn't guarantee, you know, anything. And you are a little bit out on your own. I think, but I don't know, maybe particularly for team sports, maybe it's different. I'm not sure. When you're used to being around people and kind of, yeah, sometimes following the pack. I think, yeah, that maybe is a different challenge.
Yeah. I mean, you shared with us at the conference a few weeks ago how what you learned as a captain particularly really helps you to help others now, helped you to understand leadership and some of the real qualities around leadership, and not just on the headline level, but on a human level, some of the personal human challenges that come with leadership. What did you learn particularly that's been really valuable post athletic career?
Oh, crikey. I think probably some of the psychological tools that we utilized as athletes to manage state and to have a real deep understanding and acceptance of self. I think they've been the most powerful things for me and have enabled me to then turn that around and be really empathetic to others, and where they're coming from and what they're experiencing and where they're at. You know, things like understanding, you know, what am I like on a good day or a bad day? Like really fully understanding and appreciating that behaviorally, internal voices, physically, you know, the choices, how I interact with people, everything. And the triggers, you know, what sets me off, what shifts me and moves me into a bad day. I think that knowledge of self has really helped me stop spiraling out of control, because those bad moments and bad days that we all experience can sometimes just take a hold and we can't find a way out of it. And, you know, I experienced that as an athlete from time to time, but I think these tools have helped me just shorten that a little bit, and be kind to myself and understand myself. And as I said, use that to then, you know, understand other people and help them understand themselves as well.
There's also far more variables in the outside world that can piss you off than I think in a sporting context. If something happens in a sporting context, you can say pretty bluntly to your teammates what's annoyed you. You have to bite your lip occasionally, which, as Simon also knows, is something I struggle with.
But yeah, I mean, I'm emotive. I'm hugely emotional, and sometimes that will come out as anger. Sometimes that will, you know, come out as tears. I am super emotional, and for the longest time, thought that was my greatest weakness, and locked them all away, which came at a big cost to me. But actually, realised that actually they're my greatest strength, my biggest compass, and I can use them really powerfully, and to connect to people. So I think that. You know, that, yes, things, there's absolutely way more things that can trigger that emotion. But actually, to listen to that, and I think that's really important for me. And to, you know, obviously I have to manage it, otherwise I'll be getting myself in trouble. But yeah, it's definitely helped me negotiate that in retirement.
I can remember
what are
you...
Sorry,
mate. I was going to say, I can remember you sharing an experience of... when you were a captain and a younger player came up, I think it was in the gym, were you doing chin-ups or something? And said, oh, I reckon you could do a bit more weight than that. And I can remember you sharing that with our audience at the conference, and it really struck a chord with them, because it just highlights that need to be humble as a leader.
And also understand how you give and receive feedback. Like, I am so defensive. I am, you know, as a coach now, and the players will give me feedback. Or when I'm speaking, it happened last week. Someone came up to me at the end and gave me some very honest feedback. You know, I thankfully know that I am so defensive, and I will just want to turn around and go, I disagree with you completely. I think you're wrong. You know, that'll be what my ego will completely take over in that moment. And to know that about myself has really helped me just go, right, just let it in. Just let it in. Filter it. What do you want to do with it? Then, you know, then we can move forward. But that moment in the gym was a real powerful one for me. And it was a powerful one because it really highlighted the power of our culture, that it was, we all owned it. You know, in that moment, she was absolutely the leader, although she was young, one of the youngest players in the team, one of the least experienced players in the team. She was the leader and I was the follower. I think that's the power of a really great culture. But also the depth of conversation and the depth of work we did with our psychologists around, you know, what am I like under pressure? What's my go-to reaction when I'm given some hard feedback? Where do I go? What happens to me? And to be able to understand that, thankfully I'd done it before that moment. Otherwise, she would have got my full ego outburst.
What are you asked most by businesses and corporates that you go to or you come across? You know, what do they pick your brains most on?
I'd say the easiest number one question I get asked is, what do you do with the maverick? What do you do with the talented individual performer who is also disruptive to the team? You know, maybe they're technically highly skilled at what they do, but they're also pulling energy out of the team. Like, what do you do with those people? Have you come across them? What did you do with them? I think that's, you know, we've all been in teams when you've got that person who is brilliant at what they do, but then at the same time is equally just as challenging, if not maybe more so, to the team and disruptive to the team. And actually, you're constantly weighing up, you know, is this worth it or not? Like, is this the right place for them? Is it the right fit for us? And I think that's been definitely the one I get asked every single time, pretty much.
And your core transferable skills, what are the, I don't know, top three skills that you think you've taken from sport directly into your life after sport?
Definitely that awareness of self. I think that has been the most powerful tool I could have ever been given through playing sport. I think understanding that discomfort and uncertainty and pain to some extent are necessary and actually are the is in that space where I'll grow the most.
Yeah.
And then connection to people. I think that just I know that in my life I need a deep connection to people who are aligned to with me, maybe in values, you know, maybe have completely different perspectives, points of view, backgrounds, but there is something shared in a value system. I definitely need that in my life.
How have you found that in sport, particularly that last point? It's something Simon and I have talked about. One thing I couldn't get my head around, well, I had to pretty quickly in the sort of corporate world is actually, you know, in a changing room, everyone, you might have all had different opinions, but actually you're going to the same end goal.
Yeah.
And you're all striving to do the same thing. Now, in the corporate world, oh my God, there are so many different agendas going on.
Yeah.
I'd say the vast majority of places. How have you found that in terms of being able to deal with that? I mean, it's mind-blowing to me.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think definitely there's definitely points in my career when what we were aligned to did feel very specific and almost maybe quite narrow. But I think particularly in the end, in the lead up to Rio, our vision was quite broad and people could attach themselves to it in a quite a personal way. So it was be the difference, create history, inspire the future. So there's absolutely space in there for, right, we're here to win an Olympic gold medal. Like, that's it. But there's also space in there for people to say, okay, I want to get 30,000 more inner city kids playing hockey. I want to get disability hockey up and around the country. They all mattered in their own way. Also, you know, Sam Quirk, who's, you know, on This Morning Live, you know, there was absolutely space in there for her to go, do you know, I want a career in TV off the back of this. Like, and that's also totally fine and brilliant. And that there shouldn't be any judgment there. And I went into a company a few weeks ago, and they were talking a lot about culture and alignment to this new purpose that they were unveiling. And this, I'd spoken, and this guy put his hand up, and it was just so brilliant. His honesty was just amazing, because he just went, I mean, all this culture stuff's great, but I'm just basically here to make money. And I was like, do you know, thanks. Thank you for being honest, because you're probably not alone, firstly. And also, fine, like, for you to make the money, you need to maybe do these things. You'll make the money and the company will achieve that vision. Everybody's a winner. Like, it doesn't need to be set apart. Actually, it can be really aligned. And I think the companies that embrace that personal purpose and that aligned team purpose, I think really, really get people, and people have a sense of belonging. They're more motivated, they're more inspired. I think that's where the magic lies.
I think it's quite interesting. I speak to various different athletes from different sports. There's a real sort of, you talk about it, self-awareness. People feel like they can't say, money's my driver.
Mm-hmm.
If it's your driver, it's your driver. Don't be ashamed of it. Like, almost be like your man that was in the office there. Just, you know, put your hands up. That's me. You know, acknowledge it and go with it. I mean, you're a bad person.
Well, equally in the Olympic programs, if you said, listen, I'm here for the gold medal, that's okay too. Yeah, there are quite a few people I think that would also say I'm here for the gold medal. But yeah, it's the honesty, as you said, the honesty is critical. And it doesn't mean that people have to have tug of wars over these things. We can actually achieve both at the same time often. Yes, you know, you can get your money and we can achieve what we want to. And if we do what we do well, you probably earn more money and vice versa. So yeah, we're after the same thing here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure.
Kate, we normally finish, well, we always do. We don't normally, we always do. Finish the podcast with the same four questions.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for you, it's exactly the same. Justin has, our producer, has these same four questions that he refuses to change. So, and I know you went to university and did sports science. So if you hadn't been an athlete, what would you have been? Was there a particular vocation that took your interest?
Yeah, so before I became a full-time athlete, I was studying to be a PE teacher. My parents were both PE teachers by trade, although my dad eventually became a primary school teacher and mum became a lecturer. I don't think I would know. That's exactly what I would be doing. I would be teaching PE somewhere, yeah, helping kids find that passion and hopefully passing on my passion of sport to them, which is exactly what I had. My PE teacher was just the most wonderful human being, and she passed on her passion to me. And so, yeah, I think teachers just the most amazing profession.
Good stuff. Okay, you've got two business people, well, one business person and one sports person that you have to highlight as admiring the most. Who are they?
I mean, for me, it's one person. It covers both both those headings. It's Serena Williams. I think she has broken every glass ceiling and barrier you can imagine as an athlete, as a woman in a fairly male dominated environment, and then as a Black woman. I think, you know, dealing with racism that she's had to deal with and to continue to deal with her whole life, and doing it with class, and just pushing women's tennis to a completely different level, and tennis generally. And then, you know, she's also a businesswoman. She invests in women's sport. She invests in things that she's passionate about, and she's growing, you know, a venture capital company. And I just think she's just represents, you know, everything good about the change that we've seen in women's sport and what we need to see in the future.
You talk about investment. When Justin sends through the massive bag of cash that you obviously get for being on this podcast, what are you going to invest it on?
Yeah. I think I would invest in a women's sports team. I would invest in probably a women's Super League team in this country. I think there's been loads of people investing and lots of women investing in women's soccer teams in the US. I think women's Super League in this country is just on the verge of really taking off. And I think it would be a savvy move to invest in that.
Mm.
And the final question, arguably the worst. You can only watch one film for the rest of your life. Well, it could be the best. What's it going to be?
That is such a hard question.
Now, hard can mean rubbish or it can mean really good.
I'm going to just go for the one that I have probably watched the most and I will watch forever and never get bored of. It's Love Actually. It's so British. And it's all the different people, and it's, yeah, I cry every time at Emma Thompson's character. I mean, yeah, it's just brilliant. Yeah.
Well, hopefully, depending on what order these podcasts come out in, our record earlier on was with David Campese, and he went with Indiana Jones and Star Wars. So quite different to that.
I do love Star Wars. I am a little Star Wars fan. But yeah, I'm going for Mush.
Fair enough.
It's been brilliant to chat to you. It's been really good, really informative, and it's a pleasure to have a multi-medaled individual join us on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely chatting to you, though.
Take care.
You're listening to Podium Podcast with former England rugby player Tom May and leading performance coach Simon Hartley. From locker room gossip to fascinating high performance insights, this is the show that invites some of the biggest names in the world of sport to discuss life on and off the field of play. Podium Podcast is brought to you by True Potential. To find out more, visit www.tplp.com.